all know how serious and dreadful the current situation is in Myanmar. For those of us outside the country, it can be difficult to know how to help. Of course, there are significant ongoing needs across all segments of Burmese society. For those who are able to give financially, any donation given to our nonprofit mission, Better Burma, will immediately be directed towards those vulnerable communities on the ground that need that support. Just go to insightmyanmar.org/donation or betterburma.org/donation to contribute today, or stay tuned to the end of the episode to hear more options. Thank you for your consideration, and let's get into the interview that follows.
Yes, my name is Hans-Bernd Zöllner, most English speakers say Zöllner, with a hard Z, it's the original thing. And I'm an independent scholar dealing with Southeast Asian affairs for some years. And I would say that my main research topics are the political culture and the political history in Theravada's Buddhist countries, with a focus on Myanmar, a little bit smaller focus on Thailand, where I had the chance to live for 7 years in the last millennium, and concentrating to find out about the political history and the reasons why the political history is that, deplorable as it is. What brought me to Myanmar is my original profession, in which I earned my money as a Lutheran minister, who was posted for 7 years in Bangkok, Thailand, and part of my job at that time was to look after the Germans living in Burma at that time, in the 1980s, under the Nguyen era. So my first visit was 40 years ago, in December 1984. I found the country very, very strange, try to make up my mind about what's going on there, and that developed into a career as a so-called Myanmar specialist, because after my return I started to do some research. I've been there, I would say, almost every year since 1984, for mostly short visits, maximum 4 weeks. I feel very much privileged that I had the chance to meet so many people from different walks of life, in time, from different professions, different ethnicities, different everything. And in the meantime, had to make up my mind about what is about the background of the political, cultural, and everything situation in the country. Particularly with regard to the relations of Myanmar to the international world. My first study was on German-Burmese relations after World War II, focusing on the role of a special, also particular German, a company that helped Myanmar to develop its arms industry from the 1950s onwards, and later, yeah, started to. My dissertation was done, finished in 1998, some years after I returned from Southeast Asia. And was about the relations between the two countries, focusing on the virtual relations, what was in the mindset of the people in Burma at that time, particular interest in how they perceived Hitler, National Socialism, and all these things in the context of their relations to Great Britain and the rest of the world. Anyway. And that dissertation was for me very enlightening because I discovered that these virtual relations, what is in the mindset of the people, must not be, must very much differ from what a historian might find out. And my main mission, so to speak, is to clarify the differences between the many rumors about Myanmar, the many narratives, that is a special focus of mine, and the myths going on both inside Myanmar and outside Myanmar about Myanmar, which are very much related. So the most interesting thing for me is this myth of the transition to democracy, which now obviously came to an end through the last coup 4 years ago. Yeah, that's a short introduction who I am, and the special focus is with my practical ways to, as far as possible, to share my views with the public, but that is almost a failure, mostly a failure, because the media have their own image of Myanmar, which is still a little bit like the title of one of my books, The Beast and the Beauty, the a confrontational view between good and evil. In the old days, it was the military dictators. They are still there on the one side. And on the other side, there was Aung San Suu Kyi. Now she is, her popularity is down due to what her stand in the Rohingya issue. And I would argue that both with the Rohingyas and with the understanding of democracy on the side of Aung San Suu Kyi, that was just a big understanding on the side of the Western observers, as well maybe partly in Myanmar as well.
Thank you for that introduction. We have a lot to try to talk about in a relatively short amount of time, given that extensive and extraordinary background that you suggest. And we're really happy to be speaking to you here from Hamburg to our international audience that is tuning in to this this episode to understand about your background and your study into Myanmar. I have so many questions and things I bookmarked from that introduction you gave that I'm really looking forward to get into. But I guess before we get into the further study and experience and perspective that you have in Myanmar, let's start at the beginning. 1984, Ngay wins Burma. You are a Protestant minister based in Thailand, and this is your first touch with the country. So bring us back there into both who you were as a Protestant minister in Southeast Asia, as well as far as you can to bring out, if you can take our listeners on a time travel trip back to 1984 Burma and bring up some imagery of describing what you felt and saw and remembered and what the environment was like there.
Yes, it was, of course, it was an adventure. At that time, a foreigner without close relations to the government got an 8-day tourist visa. I was advised by the German embassy in Rangoon, still had called Rangoon at the time, before the name change in 1989, to write some kind of educationalist or something, and not minister, because one of the first steps Ne-Win took after 62, two steps related to religion. First, he stopped UNU's proclamation of making Buddhist the state religion, because they had found out that, for example, the Kachins started a civil war partly because of this issue. And second, he asked, not very politely, to all missionaries to leave the country. And my double task there was twofold: to look after the German community in Myanmar, which in Burma at the time, which was quite great. Because Germany was the only country during the whole Ne-Win era that started around 1962 doing development work in the country. That is almost unnoticed from the internet until today, the public Ne-Win. In course of these good relationships between the Federal Republic of Germany, there was the German Democratic Republic as well, and one incentive for the German side to have these good relations was to prevent Burma to officially recognize the other German state. That was one reason, but the other reason had to do with World War II, and that West Germany and East Germany as well, in a different way, tried to be good guys, political good guys at that time. And there had some, according to the records I read, 62 development projects between 62 and 88, when they stopped it after the coup of 88. And to the pleasure or to the liking of the German experts working there, because they said, okay, we are working for the people, not for the government, and if you stop that. So that is one of my personal critical points to Western policy with regard to Burma. That is a roller coaster affair, up and down, and not guided by any deeper knowledge into the country. I cannot blame anybody, because Myanmar was, in even 1988, it was a backwater of international politics. Nobody was interested. There were 3, 4, 5 scholars who did some research, and most of them after 62 from outside the country. Robert Taylor and Joseph Steinberg are some of a few who went in. There was nothing, not much knowledge about the country, and the emergence of Aung San Suu Kyi against the military was a very good thing to make this beast and beauty antagonism popular. And that is still the case now. The good guys, not anymore. Aung San Suu Kyi, I find it really shameful that she was dropped by the media almost completely. And now the heroes are, the CDM, ladies and guys, and of course, the armed groups that did the civil war already for many years before the coup, and the role of the PDFs, People Defense Forces, might be disputed. And I think that this picture is much too attractive. And Myanmar's politics, especially if you concentrate on history, which is my special focus, is very, very much more differentiated, complicated, and sometimes very confusing. It's the Burmese way of thinking about history is thinking of historical cycles from the history of the kings and according to Mao Mong, the last president of socialist Burma. He applied it to the modern history after independence as well, that Myanmar is going on in cycles of 10, 15, 20 years. And if I, in my mostly, I hope, empirical research based on documents, not on rumors, this cyclical model works very well. So in terms of cycles, you know that the Burmese history is normally organized in three dynasties, starting with 2054 with the Pagan dynasty, Anuradha and co, and then the Taungi dynasty and the last one, the Kaumbang dynasty. And when Aung San, the independence hero, started, he was praised as the founder of the fourth, kind of fourth dynasty. And now Aung San is dead, Nguyen Win, his comrades in arm, is dead. And the military guys of today do not know much about Aung San personally. And Aung San Suu Kyi is out, so we are waiting for the next dynasty to come. After the Aung San dynasty and Aung San with his followers, as you know, he has had two heads, the military and the political head, or the other way around. One thing of the tragedies of Myanmar, I would say, is that the two heads, after his assassination in 1947, the two heads were separated to the military on one side and the civil side to the other side. And this parting of ways of the two functions obviously did not work.
I would like to ask about some of your early work in Myanmar. As you referenced in your introduction, you spoke about how you did research on the early German manufacturers. I assume you're referring to Fritz Werner?
Yes, that is one of the interesting stories of my life story. When I came back in 1990 here to Germany, I very quickly co-founded a German-Burmese association aiming at supporting the resistance and trying to get the military Cuba people out again as soon as possible. That, as all of us know, did not quite work. But then I learned from one of the exile Burmese guys with whom we cooperated that we Germans should be ashamed because Fritz Werner was helping producing the guns, G3 guns, which with the demonstrators in 1988, August and September, were shot dead. So, and we were to blame. This story very much attracted the German press and the German parliament, and. My problem was that I had met the people of Fritz Werner in Rangoon at that time, on receptions of the embassy, and nobody had told me that they were devils. And that was my, so to speak, initial drug to start to find out what might have been the truth with the Fritz Werner story. That was my first book, small book published in German language in 1993 then. And my investigations with the help of the German archives of the Foreign Office here, showed that it was quite a natural thing what happened. It started in 1955, just during the time of UNU, because the German army needed weapons. They needed weapons to fight the Civil War. The Civil War, not all knew, broke out contemporary with independence. First by the communists in 46, communists, there was a red flag, and one year later the white flag communists under brother-in-law of Aung San, Thanh Thun. And then in 1949, the first ethnic insurrection started with the Karen under the Christian leadership. In both cases, according to my impressions or findings, the first shots were always done by the insurgents, by the communists and the Karen, not by the Burmese army. So it was in the first years, according to my later research, I would say I can make it very very likely that they, until 1958, their relations with the civilian was not very problematic, to say. In the ministry, the minister until 1956 was Bassuet, one of the senior politicians, but one of the most influential politicians from the AFPFL, the Anti-Fascist People's Freedoms League. Bassuet was the defense minister until 1956 when he became prime minister for 1 year, or almost 1 year. And that was very much okay. And then with the transfer of power from the civilian government to the military government in 1958, which I regard as one of the most crucial events, which is, like many historical things in Myanmar, almost completely under-researched. This changed, and it came out in the 1960 elections, which showed that UNU, after the split of the Pasabalha, the FPFL, he won the elections with a landslide victory over his rival faction, the so-called stable FN. He was this clean AFPFL, meaning religiously clean, because the main thing he did was making his main electoral proposal, promise was to make Buddhism the state religion if he and his faction would win, and he did so. And the other main reason, according to the sources of that time, was that his rival faction, the social, based on the socialist in the very mixed FPFL composition, was regarded as close to the military. And the actions of the military cleaning the country after, in the 18 months between October 1958 and the elections in April 1960, which were organized by the military in a totally free and fair way, one of the very, very ironic things in Myanmar history, was that they cleaned it very effectively, military style. Ironically, all Western observers, including a lot of academics at that time, praised it, because that had never been done by the somehow incompetent politicians. But it was not, it did not went well with the people, particularly with the people in the big towns, in the a countryside, it was a different side. To give one example, the military tried to engage the people in cleaning up the city in the literal sense of the way, trying to clean from debris, make the sanitation better. And one special point to get rid of the ministry dogs, for example, in Yangon and other people. And this was against Buddhist belief, to kill stray dogs. And that is one of the reasons, and the military asked the people to help them to clean the sewages and everything else. And that went against the sense of independence and liberty of the Burmese people. It was effective, but the people didn't like it. And that was, I think, the main cause for the estrangement of the people and the people's army. And the time under Ne Win, 26 years of socialism, was making this rift between the people and the army widen the rift, unnoticed by both sides, in a way, for a long time. And if we look back, and that is one of my little bit maybe not so popular thesis, the 26 years were not so bad compared to what happened later, I would say. Right. But it was a Burmese way of doing things, as UNU had a different Burmese way of doing things. He had a Buddhist socialism scheme, and Ne Win had a secular Burmese socialist scheme, and both did not work. And my impression, you ask me for, I should answer. My impression of Burma was, it was very strange, totally different from Thailand, which was a little bit overdeveloped in my eyes. And Burma at that time, 84 to 88, was for sure totally underdeveloped, or even archaic in a way. But I felt it very comfortable to live there and look around and see how things worked and didn't work. I was in town when one of the denominations took place, where all big banknotes, the denominations were made invalid, and people, it's the first time, I think it was the 85th, the people could get something of their money back. That was to fight the black marketers from China mainly. And yeah, I found it exotic, strange, but very interesting. But when I came back to Germany, and I thought I should make up my mind, because, and that is the story with the association I co-founded, is that we were told we had to be ashamed because of Fritz Werner. And I found out that it was a quite natural progress, and that made me curious if I could find out other things other people had not found out until now. And then I had a lot of documents, so my research is based on documents. And that is a little bit due to my original profession as a theologian, which I would say is based on documents as well, and to make sense of them, and to separate the rumors from the from what might have happened really, if there's a chance to find out. So my mythology in doing Myanmar studies nowadays is the same. I'm looking at documents, in the old days, biblical documents and what happened later in church history. And now the documents I get from different sources, mostly English, but some Burmese through translations, and try to find out what might be real.
Mm. Yeah. One of my interests in Fritz Werner, why I asked you that question, is I'm not sure if you're aware of the German woman who passed away last year, Friedgard Lotermoser. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she, when she was 17 years old in 1959, she moved to Burma with her father, who went to run the Fritz Werner company. Her father had worked for Fritz Werner in the 1950s when a trade mission from Burma came to Europe. And who led this trade mission but Seyaji Ubeken? I don't know if you're familiar with Ubeken, the meditation master and also government minister and teacher of S.N. Goenka, who popularized the Vipassana movement around the world. Friedgard's father, stepfather actually, was charged with hosting Ubeken in Germany when he came for a visit, and their relationship became so close that he came to Burma to run the Fritz Werner organization in 1959, and Ubeken spent years recruiting, so to speak, her father into joining the meditation courses at
International. Oh, I didn't know that. That's a new information you
yes.
had.
So
and I must integrate it in my scholarship because that is part of German-Burmese relation and nobody told me this story
it's,
before.
It's a hidden gem that has been, listeners of this platform know that Friedgard Lotermoser has been my Moby Dick for many years in the sense that I had an obsession to get her story, like of the 500 people we've spoke to on this platform. Friedgard's access to information and the life that she lived is a story like none other. And I spent 10 years trying to get this story from her and was so fortunate to record 40 hours of content with her before she sadly passed away. We were planning on recording more. 40 hours was actually just barely scratching the surface of the life that she lived. Because as the story goes on, she, her Seyaji Ubeken was unsuccessful in getting her father, his friend, to join a course at IMC. But Friedgard, so to speak, became something of a pawn in this strategy because she developed an interest in meditation when she was 17. And so Ubeken was hoping that through her, the whole family would come and meditate. That did not happen. And when Ubeken realized that was not going to happen, he started to distance himself from Friedgard. But Friedgard was, as a 18-year-old, was a very stubborn and hard-headed girl who went after what she wanted. And when the coup happened in 62, her family left Germany. But because she had this extraordinary exception of having, it's a very complicated set of loopholes. Somehow she had received a scholarship from the UNU era that allowed her to be at Yangon University and of all the different as you mentioned, the Ne-Win regime, so many missionaries and other foreigners went out. Somehow she was in this small loophole of exception that no one really targeted her. So Friedgard lived in Burma from 1959 until 1971, which was almost unheard of as a foreigner. Not only was she there that time, she has a near photographic memory of remembering everything that happened in those years. And she became a very close disciple of Seyaji Ubeken. She spent years at IMC, of Webu Sayadaw, of Mahagandhiyon Sayadaw, and of other of some of the great monks in Burma as she got her degrees in Yangon and Mandalay universities. Mm-hmm. When she left Burma in 1971, she felt shattered because you have to remember at this, and you'll appreciate this also being a scholar of Theravada Buddhism, at this point in time, 1971, the practice of meditation is rooted to a geographic place of soil in a way that we can't really conceptualize today because everyone meditates everywhere. You could go to online apps and YouTube and courses from Germany to Argentina to Australia, you can find a course. But in 1971, as she left Burma, she believed her meditation journey was ending because there was no meditation to find anywhere else in the world at that time. So you have this daughter of the man who was helping the Burmese military manufacture these arms, who then herself was going and studying at the feet of some of the greatest Burmese meditation masters of the era that very few foreigners had a chance to meet, let alone be with for years at a time and to converse with in Burmese as well. So this is quite another remarkable wrinkle of this Fritz Werner story of the German-Burmese relations that fit in there. And it also serves as a segue into looking at where all these things are connected, because in Friedgard's life, in your study, in the experience of Myanmar itself, even though sometimes foreign observers tend to look at things in silos, they tend to look at things in a very small prism of this is human rights and this is conflict and this is Buddhism and this is humanitarian. When you're in Burma, and politics, of course, when you're in Burma, all these things are blending and interacting and informing each other. And so up till now, we've talked a bit about the culture and the politics and the history of Burma. Through Friedgard's life, we get an example of where this meditative Buddhist sense of the Burma story starts to inform the others. And you have also been a scholar of Theravada Buddhism. So I'd like to use this to then prompt you in looking at how would you describe Theravada Buddhism shaping contemporary and recent Burmese history, politics, society, etc.?
The big problem is that to make sense of the Buddhist influence on politics is that is connected, I would say, to the end of the Burmese monarchy. If that is one of my hypotheses, if the British had found a way to keep a monarch on the throne after Thibaut, then as a constitutional monarch or something like that, like in Thailand. What happened in Thailand, where I lived for 7 years, then the whole history might have been different, because the whole history since Anuradha's time until today is that Buddhism provides a legitimation of the rule of whatever. It is a special kind of relationship that the supreme patriarchs, when they were established, provide legitimacy to the ruler, and the ruler in back provides interesting way, the two sides of the arms bowls. And as you know, in Thailand, in Burma, and so if people give something in the arms bowl of the monk, the giver says thank you. Because the spiritual gifts he receives is higher than the material gift giving to the monk. And this model was practiced in Burma, until 1885, 1886. And the big problem was, after 1886, was what to do with the monks. And the British did not understand this model. They were enlightened Westerners who said, okay, we have to separate religion and politics. But religion and politics until today are not separated.
Well, they were also influenced by the 1857 Indian mutiny that happened and their views on how they should be engaging or not engaging in religion, so I understand.
Yes, that was on the Indian continent, but in a way, Burma, Myanmar nowadays was conquered just by accident. But the Indian mutiny was not so much important for Burma. What was important for, in my personal view, what was important for Burma. was that they tried to make the Buddhist religion a private method, and that the monks became engaged in politics. That is the main effort. So I did some studies, not yet quite finished, is dealing with the influence of Buddhist monks and Buddhism in the concepts of ruling Myanmar nowadays, because what is the political culture of Myanmar? It's based on Buddhism, and my thesis is that Aung San Suu Kyi's concept is based on a special kind of Buddhism, focusing on meditation, Vipassana, whereas the general's Buddhist legitimation is derived from karma theory. And I have written some books about that, and I think these two Buddhist concepts do not work well together, and this beast and beauty metaphor is both based their concepts on Buddhist thing, because there is no other cause for political legitimation in the country, in a mainly Buddhist country like Myanmar. That is my personal view, but it's of course maybe just a political fantasy, but I think I have a lot of interesting stuff to give some credit that it hypothesis that might be worth considering.
So you believe that if the British had appointed a new Thathanabhine, the head of the Sangha at the time, that that this head of the order...
No, he did not. They did not abolish the Thathanabhine. Was kept. But what they should have found is a monarch who would be able to do what happened in Thailand, a constitutional monarchy. And I lived in Thailand for 7 years, and it took me 3 or 4 years to get the concept of why this country, how this country worked. And it was because it was a Buddhist monarchy who had... with the father of the present king, was liked by the people and had an indirect political influence. And this did not happen in Myanmar. In Myanmar, from the 1920s on, it was the students and the monks who directed the protests against the British, who led the protest movements, and these two factors were very unlikely political actors, monks and students, because they were apprentices in their respective works. And I think this problem of the religious influence in Myanmar politics until today is the most crucial point, which did not cause the attention of Western scholars, politicians, and the like.
So you believe that they have misinterpreted or misread recent Burmese history?
They have completely misread Burmese history.
How would you inform or revise their misunderstanding?
I do my best, but people are not interested in in such a very far away scholarship work of a scholar, and that is another point that there is no real Myanmar scholarship around the world. There are many centers of scholarship. Some in Germany, one lady doing teaching Burmese, but no professor. There was one in Heidelberg for one time, Professor Sarkisians, a very eccentric guy, and another one in Göttingen, a German scholar who did a lot of work, especially with relations of politics and religion. But anyway, there is nothing, and this special interrelationship of politics and religion, which is I'm a little bit specialized on, that is has not made it to the minds of politicians, development workers, and other people who worked in Myanmar. That is one of the tragedies, that the people who work in Myanmar, foreigners worked in Myanmar, nowadays almost nobody left, that they do not really understand the political impact of Buddhism. And the political impact of Buddhism is that the kings of old were legitimized by Buddhism through the Satsangabangs and Buddhists, and there was a double apex of the hierarchy, the king. And this was destroyed when the British brought Thibaw into exile. And already before, that is one of my findings of archive material, is that 1 year before the war, there was a big gathering in Rangoon at that time of merchants of all many nationalities, including Burman or Burmese merchants, and they sent a message to the British government with the call to make an end to Thibaw's rule, because of the massacres happening after his enthronement in 1986 or 87, and another alleged or real massacre that happening in the prisons in 84. That was the reason, and superficially talked, the main reason they argued was human rights. And that is an interesting factor, because that's still on the top of the agenda. And according to my looks into the Buddhist understanding of human rights, I wrote some articles for a German dictionary that was funded by the German Foreign Office as a helpful thing for diplomats all around the world to deal with this thing of religion and so. According to this, the understanding of human rights, especially of rights, in the Theravada Buddhist context, is totally different from ours.
Mm. What is that? How would you describe the understanding of human rights from a Buddhist Theravada perspective?
The problem is that the rights issue, which is the main focus in our Western understanding, human rights are seen as civil rights in a way. In the Buddhist context, the question is, who is the owner of rights? The owner of rights as an individual is not possible. You know Buddhism very well, I'm sure. And according to the main principle of anatta, no self. There can be no self that owns rights. And that's, they always say, I did some work on Buddhism and human rights. And what all these enlightened Buddhists say, there is a small difference. We agree with all the results, everything okay with Buddhism, but not the right issue. Because a person cannot claim to have rights. It's a thing of anatta, and the main exit into the nirvana is can only achieved by a person who has found the exit to this nirvana, this coolness, whatever it is described. And there is a concept, I did some research on Thai Buddhist scholars, Buddhadasa and Prapayuto and others. And there is a collective karma and a way, but there is no collective way to collective liberation through Buddhist meditation. But that is difficult to understand for a Western mind. One of my results of my research is the assumption, I stress assumption, that the generals from 1988 on, totally different from Le Guin, believe what they do. Because they are legitimized by the good karma that they must have deserved in their former lives. And therefore, they are legitimate rulers. And the other interesting thing is the case of the one of the famous Sayadaws who works together with them. I visited his monastery and I just missed his way, the Sitagu Sayadaw. He supports them. He gives advice to the building of the pagodas. This is the background story of the Buddhist the Buddhist legitimation of military rule, in a way.
And I should say you're referring to a book that you wrote titled A Religious State Affair, The Story of Chautaji Pagoda and Insane.
That is, I think, it shows that after 88, they tried to legitimize themselves. And our Western concept in the age of enlightenment, that has not quite reached Burma, Myanmar. There are, so my metaphor is there are many enlightened people in Burma, Myanmar. But there is no culture of enlightenment, like in the Western countries after the Reformation, after the Age of Enlightenment, Kant, and. So that was a special culture separating religion from reason. And that differentiation did not happen in Thailand as well, in all Theravada Buddhist countries in a different way. It did not happen. And it did not happen in all of the Islamic world, this Western concept of enlightenment. Different Islamic, Buddhist, and concepts of enlightenment, but different. And that is, for politicians and people of the media who concentrate on what is going on actually, it's different. So I don't blame anybody that he doesn't get my enlightened ideas about non-enlightened Buddhists. What I would like to blame people for something that I do not know their limitations and understand a strange culture like that in Myanmar and Thailand and other countries.
You referencing that Buddhist monks have told you that the concept of anatta or no self, no ego, that this concept prohibits or prevents a Buddhist from claiming their human rights because there's no self to have human rights.
I did a lot of research on, there is a lot of literature on Buddhism and human rights, and I read all the articles, most of them written by Westerners.
Mm-hmm. Well, this concept, this is very, very dangerous in some ways to propose because it's a very thin line from that type of reasoning into suggesting that there's no, and this is something we hear not just in the Buddhist world, but in many non-Western contexts, is that, oh, your understanding of human rights in your country, that's different. We don't need that here. We do things differently. And this is often some version of a propagandized argument that you hear from despots and authoritarians.
This whole topic is very, very, very dangerous. Mm. But in both sides, on the, when I try to step in the shoes of, the military, what is a hard thing to try. They could claim that we are, the Western powers are still continuing what the colonialists did. And this is the rhetoric of the generals until today.
Sure, it's an easy scapegoat in some ways.
Yeah, but it started with UNU. It started in 1920 when the Buddhist monks supported the boycott movement against the first elections. I'm just writing a book on my last big work on the history of elections between 1922 and 2020. General elections, multi-party general elections, including the one-party system. And it's, for me, it is quite evident that the Western type of democracy basing on the competition of elections in a, say, a capitalist way, demand and supply, and so, it did not work. Empirically, it did not work because we had never had a numerically strong opposition in those elections that were performed. The 1960 elections, I told about already about, when UNU's faction won with a promise to make Buddhism the state religion. The stable AFP was devastated, but decapitated in a literal sense because all the leading members, Basue, Xionyen, they lost the competition against UNU and the leading of the clean FPFL. It was really steady. And the same happened with Aung San Suu Kyi. That is more interesting. She always won landslide victories. And I always wondered if the people in Myanmar are crazy because they must know that to vote for a party that only depends on one charismatic leader who will die one day. The party will die as well. And that is what happened. So this is a very, very, very sensitive issue. Mm. And the problem is, not for me, but I think for our Western world, is that we have not yet realized these problems, that political culture, that is one of my basic topics I would like to categorize my own scholarship. To do political culture, and political culture includes the religious effects, the more or less secularized effects of religion into the political cultures of Islam, Buddhism, and other, and the five Theravada Buddhist countries are a fine object of working on these things. And Thailand and Myanmar are in a way uneven twins. In Thailand, we have a military junta governing as well, but nobody cares because, the king, even if he is not liked by the people, Holds the country together, and this did not happen in time. It is just a hypothesis, but I think it makes some sense to think about it.
Well, of course, even if somehow the king or the head of the Sasana was had not been deposed by the British, you're still looking at a Bamar and a Buddhist that are in some kind of leadership role in a country that's extraordinarily diverse and has many non-Buddhists and many non-Bamar that are also a part of it and may not recognize the relevancy or legitimacy of someone of the central authority, so to speak.
My argument is that in the whole history of Myanmar, there was no concept of what we call nowadays a political state and national identity, then Buddhism. There was, Scott's book, The Art Not to be Governed. There were the Buddhist kingdoms in the plains, which organized a Buddhist state where Buddhism legitimized rule. And there was a more or less democratic small entities on the hills, which did not were not able to found empires, and they lived in a kind of a tense relationship for all years. And when the Westerners came and had the idea that every nice country needs its borders, then they were brought together and had to live in a country, and that did not work in Myanmar, at least. In Thailand, it worked because of the king. In Cambodia, it worked not very well, because not much is known about the Buddhist roots of the Khmer Rouge. But the way of this kind of what we call cruelty is still an open question. And Laos is very well with the Communist Party there. And the Chinese influence, of course, that is helping the generals in Myanmar as well. I'm no friend of the generals, but I think that is a big problem for us to understand. They believe in that what they do, and they do not follow the enlightened argument that they use religion. They don't want to persuade the people to elect them. That's why they have this interesting constitution of 2008, where they say they institutionalize the military as an opposition. And that is, just food for thought. It cannot be proven. It can hardly be disproved.
Right. So you've mentioned how some of your writing and ideas are unpopular, can be controversial. These are ideas that go into Myanmar history, politics, religion, the military, the NLD, Aung San Suu Kyi, the democracy movement, the generals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot in here to explore and to pick apart, but I want to start by inviting you, looking at those various actors and looking at some of the concepts that you have put out there in the arguments in your research. Give us one sense of an unpopular idea that would represent your take on some aspect of this Myanmar history or Myanmar contemporary issues.
Yeah, I would just elaborate a little bit more on the rise and fall of Aung San Suu Kyi in the Western perception.
Yeah.
She was, she got this started when the European Union awarded her the Sakharov Prize as a model of democracy and human rights and fighting a dictatorship communist Sakharov thing. And then Václav Havel was instrumental in saying, oh, choose her, not me, for the next version. And it was some Oxford academics that proposed giving it to her in 1990, after the 1998, after the democratic elections in 1990 had been nullified by the military. In my study on the elections, I very find out why they did so. They did it on the advice of Ne Win, who in his famous or infamous speech in July 1988, he said, okay, I step down. I think I'm a little bit at fault with why that the people are not like our one-party government, the BSPP government. And then I would like to propose you the party congress to ask the people if they would like to prefer a multi-party system through a referendum. The interesting thing is, for me, in a democratic way, the party congress refused. They accepted this resignation and that of Sun Yu and the others who wanted to resign. But they, in a democratic way, that is my way of Buddhist democracy. They refused him his proposal to later, Mao Mao accepted it. And he even over-accepted it because he said, okay, we do not need any referendum. We just start. And the first, and now we, we have to go into details, and details are always difficult to understand if you just like the broad and great, great lines. But the first election commission who prepared the elections in 1991 was appointed by the last BSPP government, according to the rules of the one-party elections held before. So, and it happened in a constitutional void, because the constitution of 1974 was null and void with the coup. And the generals just really realized it a little bit later, and then Song Mao was really not capable of doing things very well. I did a lot of research on his speeching. He said, oh, I'm not a politician. I'm just would be happy to get relieved from this post. And Sun Shui was quite a different guy and a very clever manager of all these things. And so under him, Burmese way to democracy, different from UNU and different from Aung San. He tried his own way. His follower, Minh Anh Lai, was not that clever, I would say. He and some of my Burmese friends with I discuss these argue that I may not be quite wrong with my assumptions. Yeah. Mm.
And so then going back to the story of the rise and fall of Aung San Suu Kyi, where does she then fit into the subscription?
Yes, if you read, and I read her writings in that are available in English. Part of it, I edited her speeches giving in 1995 and 1996 over the gate of her houses. And that is the best source, I would say, because it is speaks to her people, not to Western audiences. The interviews giving to Ellen Clement are very instructive as well, but these talks over the gate. And I got the Burmese transcriptions in Japan, and I found somebody to translate it into English and published it. Not many people read it because it was published in Germany, and Yeah, you, as a German scholar who is not affiliated to a big institution and has no money, it's a little bit difficult to get a publisher. My last book might be published by, if it comes out, by Springer, and then it makes me famous. No, just kidding. This Aung San Suu Kyi story was, she was elevated to a throne that she had not applied for. She was under house arrest at the time, and it is quite clear from the speeches given at the ceremony in Oslo that they had the feeling that the same was happened with Mandela, or that if they gave Nobel Prize, that it would change the politics in Myanmar. But the opposite happened. It hardened the politics in Myanmar. So, and that was the first big misunderstanding, because Michael Harris knew a little bit about Buddhist politics, but the Nobel Prize people did not know nothing. And nobody all over the country would understand what could be the meaning of democracy in the Burmese political context, in the context of Burmese political culture. Nobody could know. And that was a big misunderstanding, and all development aid, the Germans, the Japanese were a little bit more cautious because they were Asians and was not so fascinating with our Western idea of democracy. And that is my tale of the story. I don't expect that anybody believes me, but I think there are some good arguments for my version of history. And then they supported Aung San Suu Kyi. They did the boycott things, 1996, the USA and the EU. I had a number of talks with German ambassadors in Burma. They were not happy with that, because they were not happy with Aung San Suu Kyi, whom they described as very straightforward, very, very arrogant, in a way. But it was EU sanctions and it had to be performed. And then they were happy with the transformation period after 2012. And one of the most important elections I'm just writing about was the 2012 elections. And the most important thing was, that is really for outsiders a small detail maybe, but I think it's the main thing. They accepted the constitution by taking the oath to become a member of parliament under the 2008 constitution, which was clearly made by the military. And already in 1993, when they started the process of the National Convention. So, and then Aung San Suu Kyi became prominent. Democracy seemed to be on the way. After 2015, nobody in the West, I do not know anybody, who they were always skeptical because of the military, but they always hoped that the military would might to change the clauses, 59F, with this clause that relatives with a foreign passport cannot be applicants for the highest posts in the country, the other part is that the 25% of the military parliamentarians can boycott all changes of the constitution that they don't like. It was always I was maybe a kind of daydreaming that they thought that could be changed in this transition to democracy. And in my version of reality, two concepts of democracy coexisted for 5 years or 6 years, 5 years, yeah. The Aung San Suu Kyi way of founding democracy on the concept of the Mahasamatha, the great elect of the Aganya Sutta. That is her concept, and she wrote it in 1989 in her essay on. And if we look into her speeches to her followers on in University Avenue, I attended one of these meetings myself, was quite clear that she wanted to educate the people to follow her path of a peaceful revolution through, to the implementation of what she wrote in her famous essay, Freedom of Fear. Mm. A very ambitious project, I would say. And that did not work. And when then she was in a kind of diarchy system, a little bit the same concept like the British diversion of power, a little bit parliament, a little bit military rule in the old days from the British soldiers and the British generals and Burmese and mostly Indian soldiers this was tried 5 years, and obviously it did not work. And the second misunderstanding was that the Western understanding in Asian the Asian view was always very very different from the Western way. From the beginning, the Westerners did not like that Myanmar became a member of ASEAN in 1997. And this was just a Western misunderstanding of how the concept of democracy could be made a foundation for a political identity of such a multicultural thing. And even the Buddhists have different concepts of how rule is concept. Mahasamatha is one way, karma, good karma is another way. And the kings were legitimized by both concepts. And to put it very simply, after Aung San's death, the two concepts, karma plus Mahasamatha, came together in his person, became separate. And one way military, one civil. And both ways could not meet, and the last coup was the result.
Right. So if we look at the military's view on the karma aspect of Buddhism, I think that listeners might have an understanding of how this has played out. We hear so many examples of the way that they're trying to do this karmic balance of doing good deeds or merit and building pagodas or making donations on one hand as they carry out any number of atrocities on the other. But you mention on the other side, we have Aung San Suu Kyi and the democracy movement, which has not a karmic view of Buddhism, but centers it on meditation. Can you unpack and flesh that out a little more?
That is the big problem for me as a scholar who lived in Theravada Buddhist countries for 7 years and goes forth and back since then, is one of my popular phrases is after dealing with the politics of Myanmar for some decades, I think I know why this circle of misfortune happened. But I don't understand the mindset of the Burmese people. Another metaphor is after some years when I try to make up my own mind, I read a lot of books from people who visited Myanmar and were fascinated by the kind and nice people and this Buddhist culture. And one day I said, okay, how can I resolve this riddle or this antinomy that so many, let me say, 50 million nice people minus a few scoundrels on the top, 50 people have always such a bad government? What is, why?
Mm. Yeah, that's the question.
That was my question, and my answer is that the people follow a different, mainstream people follow a different concept of Buddhist tradition, the Mahasamatha concept, propagated by Aung San Suu Kyi.
And what is this? Can you tell us this concept?
This concept is also the Mahasamatha story is a Buddhist creation story, in a way, of one of the many worlds through which there is no beginning and no end in Buddhist theory, different from the Christian concept, where there was a creation and there will be an apocalypse one day. And the Buddhist concept of what the Aganeya Sutta tells is that in the beginning of this period of time, some kind of people who were not real human beings, but on the way to become that, came together and found that something went wrong in them. The problem was how to deal with rice. They stored rice and stole rice. And when people stole rice, which was not very nice, then there were some no real justice. And they said, okay, the world will fall into chaos. And that is the basic anthropological view of Buddhism in all schools, that a human being is a natural character. That is maybe the concept comparable to the Christian concept of sin, in a way, or original or sin or something like that. Okay. And that the people were not quite out of mind at that time and said, oh, we have to do something to prevent from, us from getting a chaotic society. And with murders and theft and everything else. And so we have to elect or select somebody who is caring, and that is really ironical, for law and order. And in return, we will give him a portion of our rice. Introduction of taxes. Okay, that was a deal. And the first Mahasamatha said, okay, I accept. He cared for law and order. And the kings, Buddhist kings in Thailand, Myanmar, Cambodia is a little bit different because the Hinayana and Mahayana schools are always mixed. But in Laos and in Sri Lanka as well, this concept was accepted, this Mahasamatha. And it meant that the vote, if there was a vote, it's just a story, but imagine it was a vote, it was for 100% plus and of lifetime. And if you look empirically in my research on elections, we had never a strong opposition in all post-independence elections. UNU was a charismatic and got all this landslide roads. The same happened to Ocean G. And when, and that's an interesting thing, looking at the water behavior in Myanmar, a riddle that I cannot solve, that has to be done with Burmese colleagues, is when Suu Kyi boycotted and the NLD boycotted the elections of 2010. Then the landslide victory was won by the USDP. That speaks for interesting mindset of the special of the voters in the rural areas. And in my conversations with Burmese, of course, educated Burmese things, that I always had one opinion: we have to educate the people. And that was the same what Aung San Suu Kyi did, or tried to do. But to educate the people to a Western style of democracy in a country like Myanmar takes decades. And therefore, and that is another one of my little bit heretic thoughts, is that the introduction of a series of elections was counterproductive. Because the big problems of Myanmar originating in when the country became independent, because it was a divided country. The main part, Burma proper, was organized with elections since 1922. The rest, the border areas, no elections. The traditional rulers, Chin, Kachin, Chan, Kaya, Kareni, could do what they want in the old way, only accept the superiority of the British and the sovereign. That's a little bit the same under the kings of Burma, when they had to accept the supremacy of the Burmese kings. So that was this concept, top-down structure. Why Aung San Suu Kyi of the Mahasamatha was okay. Still in the minds of the people that it must be a just ruler. And we elect or select a just ruler. I would prefer select. And with one voice. And what the, when the British introduced elections, and that happened shortly after 2022, the interesting thing is that the percentage of people who voted in 1922, do you know the number? No, 6.9%. And the suffrage was limited only to taxpayers, to the educated people. So, I would not say the elections were boycotted. They were ignored because they had no meaning. For another metaphor to make this a little bit understandable, the Burmese concept of democracy is a concept of qualitative democracy. The quality of the rulers comes first. And the Western concept is a concept of quantitative democracy. The number of votes comes first. And this concept must be organized and institutionalized in a very complicated way. And that did not work in Thailand up to now. It did not work in Myanmar. It did not work in Cambodia. It did not work in Laos. And it worked hardly well in Sri Lanka. So my thesis is based on culture, but supported by empirical data.
And I'd like to shift the focus now slightly, although these things are all connected. And we were looking at more Aung San Suu Kyi and looking now at the military. Now, the military is an easy target for anyone out there to make. They've been likened to a terrorist organization, a mafia outfit. They're inflicting atrocities on their people. It's when one says, as you suggested before, that and the broader strokes of how the Myanmar story has been portrayed of good versus evil and black versus white. Of course, there's so much nuance in there historically to pick apart and to understand in some more detail. However, when one is looking, especially at the post-2021 Minaung Laing military regime activity, it's a bit harder for some to see where that nuance fits in. If there's ever an example of evil, one often looks at the current incarnation of the Burmese military, and it's pretty hard for some to be able to break down nuance in that assessment, as well as to put, aside from perhaps those in the military who don't have much choice, to put yourself in their shoes, in their rationale, certainly of the generals and the leadership in terms of the harm and the terror they're inflicting. But I want to give you the opportunity to, if you feel that there are some overriding narratives or some lack of nuance in understanding what the military is doing, how they're thinking about it, looking at the perspective from their side, would you break that down into further nuance, or do you, at least in this current incarnation, take a view that this is a pretty horrendous, inexcusable regime that there's not much to pick apart?
So my scholarship is based, it's a little bit old fashioned. I'm literally old school due to my age. In my research, I try to keep apart moral issues and scientific issues. I absolutely do not like what the military does. I understand the work of the groups that try to abolish military rule in Myanmar. I do not like their methods of killing because it's just an act of defense. But if it will be end in a peaceful Myanmar, it's totally open. And the big problem is that in Myanmar culture, and that is almost an imperial fact, I would say, there is no tradition of compromise. Look, one empirical example is the murder of Aung San, the assassination in the cabinet. That is just the same scheme returning from what happened in the royal times. There were always fights about the succession issue. And the last big solution when the British witnessed it, because there was a British resident, when the big assassination of some 80 noble sons and daughters of King Mindon happened, that was a massacre, of course. But it was a massacre in the Burmese style to prevent a long fight about the issue of whom to. The war was put on by, was 18 years at the time, he was put by a court clique on the throne. And the others were killed in a royal way to prevent more fighting. That was the system, and of course, in the Western ways, it was against any kind of human rights. And my problem is, I tried to say it with another metaphor before, we do not understand the mindset of Burmese people. And that might be a kind of Western arrogance, post-colonial arrogance, that we think that we are able to step in their shoes or even their minds. And the other thing, more practically speaking, is even in the times when Aung San Suu Kyi was state councillor, prime minister or so, something like that, all events of importance were done behind, or talks of importance were done behind closed doors. In Naypyidaw. No transparency, like in the times of the kings, even with Aung San Suu Kyi. And that is difficult to explain. And so there is, we can, I would argue that we, be it scholars, people who have an interest in Myanmar, podcasters, politicians, or other people, have to be content with our hypothesis that we can develop. But that we must not argue that our judgments are really true. That is a moral appeal. But that is my understanding of scholarship, to separate these things. And after 88, scholarship on Myanmar, Burma Myanmar, was heavily politicized until today. Very difficult to have a... And there are... I would say there is no real Myanmar scholarship because there are a lot of conferences. Last year, I visited a conference in Chiang Mai. So many panels, so many things, totally disturbing and confusing. But there are no real dialogues, neither inside the country nor outside the country, about how to solve this difficult situation and save lives. Mm. That's yeah, big dilemma, big problem, and nobody has a solution. And the concept of blaming a culprit, I would say, is yeah, maybe it's a part of the problem.
So would you not blame this current military regime?
I would, as a private guy, I blame the Burmese people and I blame the PDFs as well.
By Burmese people, you mean the Burmese military. So you're saying, as a private person, you're blaming equally the Burmese military and the PDFs. Is that the case?
I blame both of them, of course. From a moral point of view, and especially from a Buddhist point of view.
Do you consider yourself a Buddhist?
I'm still, my wife says I'm more a Buddhist than a Christian. I'm a little bit mixed.
Okay.
And you did Vipassana training. I did a little bit, not so much as you, but I got the basic ideas, I hope. And I try to practice them. I try to get calm Buddhism, the core of Buddhist teaching does not like, and I know Unu and Somaung and San Shui and Aung San Suu Kyi, they had different concepts about a peaceful to achieve peace. And this goes back to the royal times that there was always a way to legitimize violence in these countries. There are a lot of books about the wars about the between the Burmese and the Siamese kings, old ties, and one of the interesting. The stories is a film made by the Thai politician who Pridi Banomyong, the king of the white elephant, where he makes a story about the time. Frame is the fight of the Burmese and the Siamese kings, and in a very human way, just a duel between the king and the crown prince, and the winner takes it all. A very human concept of war. Yeah.
Mm. And that statement seems to be setting up a contrast where you're saying, as a private person, I this, but then as a scholar, I feel, so I want to prompt you to finish that sentence.
As a scholar, I try to understand why people do what they do.
Uh-huh. And then what is your understanding as to why the military is doing what they're doing post-2021?
Yeah, my arrogant question would be, read my books. Here is the answer in this book. Ken Yund, in preparing for the whole junta, the establishment of the Choctaw GPR with a marble Buddha they found in 2000, in the year 2000. And his argument was when the Buddha image, 60% finished, sculptured, was left Sajin Hills, northwest of Mandalay, to insane. That he said, oh, it's not no accident that this marble, big marble Buddha block was found this time under SPDC regime. It happened before at King Mindon's time. And he built a big marble Buddha still to be witnessed, to be seen in Mandalay, the Choctawji of Mandalay. It is no accident. And he then said, it is because Mindon deserved it through his karma, and we as SPDC deserve it because of our good karma. That he said verbally, and it was quoted in the New Light of Myanmar, and I found the quotation and said, oh, that makes sense. they did a lot. They invited the tooth relic from Beijing. One of the two tooth relics of the the Buddha left four tooth relics. Two are here, one in Sri Lanka, and one came to Beijing. The others are in heaven, somewhere. So. And what the Chinese did a clever thing, they tried tooth diplomacy. Okay. And this tooth relic comes to Myanmar from time to time. UNU wanted it, and the generals invited it to come. And thousands or even millions of people come at these occasions to pay homage to the tooth relic and get good karma, merit through it. And I was there when Hillary Clinton came to Myanmar, and the tooth relic was there. Nobody except the Westerners and some intellectual Burmese were interested in Hillary Clinton. No. All were interested. And I saw the long row of people going to the Peace Pagoda, to the built by UNU, where the big synod had been held. And just to get, Buddhism is still alive in this way that we call a little bit superstitious.
Sure, yeah.
And that's, this was, and this way of doing, and my argument is that the military protect Buddhism, like the king said them, not to win elections in the first place, but to legitimize themselves through, with the help of the leading body of the Sangha, the Buddhist clergy. And they do so. Nobody objects. There are many monks who object because the monkhood has democratized, like after the in a way after Thibaut's exile, and that is a part of the big problem, that the relationship between the state and the Sangha is difficult, because a democratic Sangha, according to Theravada Buddhism, is not possible. It must be united, otherwise chaos will come. But that's very difficult to transport to to enlightened or half enlightened Western audiences.
Sure. So then how would you, with that background of understanding, again, looking at this question of the post-2021 Minaon Lang military regime, if you have your scholar hat on and you're trying to understand their motivations for what the rest of us see as just one horrifying atrocity heaped one after the other after the other, again, this kind of hybrid terrorist mafia organization, is there something in that characterization that you think is lacking nuance or unfair as you try to get into the minds of those generals?
Yeah, that's a problem. I cannot get in the mind. I think I have good reasons not to believe, because that's already a little bit of a religious term, to state that they believe that they are right. The other side, and that is difficult to understand for any Westerner, is that they think it's a fault of the people if they do not understand that we must do what we do. We do it because we think it's necessary, because a ruler is ordered to care for law and order. That is, besides, concept of the Mahasamatha as well. And of course, it is no accident that we are rulers. You know the old concept, and people like we tend to believe that this westernized, enlightened way of separating religion and reason is universal. I think that is not true. And we have, it's not true in the Ukraine-Russian conflict, it's not true in China, it's not true in Africa. It's almost only true in some, it's even not true anymore in America, in the USA, if we look at Trump's understanding of democracy. I think this old-fashioned concept of democracy, telling the votes and then everything will be fine, counting the votes and then everything is fine, is suffering a crisis worldwide. But that's the global view. But for my position, I think that means our diplomats, should try to understand what's going on in Myanmar. My analysis is that since 1988, they did not understand anything. Many scholars did not understand as well, because they did not see and did not know what happened in the colonial period, what did not happen in the pre-colonial period, and they did not know the concepts of legitimacy, of legitimating rule in a country, in a Buddhist country like Myanmar. And it is quite clear that this multicultural country, that the electoral system, in a way, still the same, adopted from the British, like in 1922, is still going on. It is always makes no real sense. And it's almost impossible. I have no idea how this problem can be used, others than the fighting parties might be exhausted one day, and with the help of China and maybe India and more enlightened Western policies, find a solution to a more peaceful coexistence of the different groups fighting one each other.
Well, I thank you very much for taking the time to join us and have this conversation. And give us a lot of teasers about a lot of different angles of your scholarship, and definitely recommend that listeners look into your books and to be able to delve much deeper into some of these conversations.
Yeah, my last reflection is just a personal one. I would invite anybody who is interested in a still predominantly Buddhist country like Myanmar and other countries where he would like to go and visit if the situation would be better, to get some kind of basic interest in the roots of the religion and maybe try to make a difference between the root of religion, which is always can only be grasped individually, and the institutionalization of religion. And there was a famous saying about Jesus made by a Catholic scholar early 20th century, when the secular scholarship on Christianity and the Bible, New Testament, happened, which I studied in a totally secular way, like any human written document. And he said, according to the scholarship of the day, Jesus, and I have to add the Apostle Paul as well, waited that the kingdom of God would come very soon. What happened to come was the church. So, to institutionalize religion is always a problem. And we have to try to find our own way to our mix of personal religion that we believe in and in which we can many our daily life and do as much good things according to our belief system as possible.
In a world where Myanmar's crisis has largely faded from the headlines, critical voices and perspectives are often left unheard. And that's where we hope to come in. Through this humble platform, we're trying to provide something unique, an opportunity to share important experiences, insights, struggles, and perspectives in depth and in a way that few other media sources offer. Our content not only keeps the sputtering global conversation about Myanmar alive, but it also brings much-needed attention to those now fighting for their freedom and dignity. So if you value this work and the perspectives we're offering, please consider supporting us. Your contributions help us to continue to amplify those voices and provide the world with the coverage Myanmar so desperately deserves. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to stand with us.
Oh, ba, yarananda, yarananga, yarananda, 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 y